Tonight we make our way a little bit farther into the book of 1 Kings. We are at chapter 19 talking about King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. And at the forefront of our discussion for the past couple of weeks has been, of course, Elijah the prophet. We said at the very beginning that one of the things about Ahab is that he plays a very important role in introducing us to Elijah. Now, that's not to say that there wouldn't have been some other character that God would have needed Elijah's help in overcoming and defeating, but Ahab fills the role of Elijah and God's adversary very well. And it is in this study of King Ahab that we grow to appreciate Elijah and his work more and more. Have you ever been up against something that seemed to take so much out of you and seemed to just bring to mind everything that should be better but isn't better, everything that you should be winning in but you're losing, everything that should be right but it seems like it's wrong? That's kind of where we find Elijah tonight in 1 Kings chapter 19. We talked last week about that great encounter on Mount Carmel between Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal. The end of that story was the end of the 450 prophets of Baal, basically. And that was kind of the note on which the chapter ended there, chapter 18. And, of course, this all sort of came out of the fact that Ahab and his wife Jezebel, who was not even a Hebrew, she was a Sidonian, and introduced into Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, the worship of the false god Baal. But because of their sinfulness and their corrupt influence upon the kingdom, one of the illustrations of which we saw in our first lesson there at the end of chapter 16, where the Bible tells about that man who, in spite of the direct instruction that God gave through Joshua that no one was to rebuild the city of Jericho, and in fact, if anyone did, he would lay the foundations of it with the death of his firstborn, and he would hang the gates of the city with the death of his other son. And chapter 16, verse 34 says that it was in the days of Ahab that Hiel, the Bethelite, built Jericho and laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub. And as we read that passage in our first study, we said that one of the things that generally follows is when you have corrupt, sinful leadership, there doesn't seem to be any end to the progression of wickedness and defiance of God. We see that not only here in the Old Testament, in the Bible story, but I think we can see illustrations of it in real life all around us today. When our leaders, whether we're talking about our leaders in this nation or the leaders of any given nation, when the leaders of a nation are wicked and corrupt and tell God to basically take a hike, shove God aside, then the life and times of that nation are generally characterized by corruption and wickedness. And that was the kind of kingdom that the northern kingdom of Israel had become, not only under the rule of Ahab, but his predecessors as well. But the Bible tells us that Ahab was the most wicked one yet. No one had led Israel into sin as much as Ahab had. And because of that wicked leadership and rule, the nation followed. And, of course, we've got a situation where the entire place is so wicked, God decided that he would send a drought to get their attention. And you remember the Bible tells us both here and also in the reference in James, a little book near the end of the New Testament, that that drought lasted over 3 years. And at the end of chapter 18, last Sunday night, we found an end to the drought. The rain came, and as we closed our study, Ahab had left Mount Carmel, headed back to Jezreel, and Elijah made the, some say, about 17-mile journey, even faster than Ahab did. In other words, when Ahab got back to the city gates of Jezreel, there was Elijah the prophet standing there waiting on him. And surely that must have made an impression. Well, let's move on with the story now and look at chapter 19 and see what happens next. And what happens next is not good. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. In other words, Ahab couldn't wait to get back and report to Jezebel and say, "Honey, you..." I doubt he called her honey in all honesty. I just can't picture that. But he said, whatever he called her, Jezebel... Jezebel, you would not believe what Elijah the prophet has done. He's killed all 450 prophets. You know, we see as much from this as anything that has happened so far, the true spiritual posture of Ahab. Why didn't Ahab go back home to Jezebel and say, "You know, enough is enough. You have persuaded me to lead this entire nation of people into this Baal worship business. And I have just seen with my own eyes an illustration that nobody could argue with, that Jehovah is God and that Baal is nothing. Now get rid of all of the rest of these people that further this worship and get rid of all of those high places and let's tear down all of those idols. We're about to make a new start right here." Obviously, though, that's not what happened, is it? He couldn't wait to get back and say, "You just won't believe what Elijah has done now. He has drug us through this 3.5 years of drought where people, our constituents, our voters, have been starving to death and going without any kind of food and necessary clothing and shelter because our economy has just been destroyed by this drought, and Elijah is the one that brought it on us, and now he's killed all your prophets." And Jezebel said, well, actually, she sent a messenger. She sent a messenger to Elijah, verse 2, saying, "So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." In other words, in 24 hours, you're going to be dead. I'm going to see that you are killed. I'm going to kill you just like you killed all my prophets. And I'm going to do it within 24 hours. "So may the gods do to me and even more." She expressed this in the form of a vow. She pledged. She promised. "Elijah, you're a dead man." And according to what verse 3 says, Elijah believed her. And he was afraid. Rose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. In other words, he fled from the territory of the northern kingdom of Israel and went down into the territory of the southern kingdom of Judah. Pretty good place to hide, I would think, from the queen of the northern kingdom. And he left his servant there, but verse 4 says, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he acted like Jonah. I can't help but insert that there, even though Jonah and his story will come many years later, he did just about the same thing that Jonah did. He sat down under a juniper tree and requested for himself that he might die. He said, "It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my father." I think in order to properly understand this situation, we need to remember the kind of pressure that has been brought to bear on Elijah at this point. Not only is he fleeing for his life now because of this immediate threat from Jezebel, but look at all that he's gone through in just the few days before this time. He's exhausted. He's doing the work of the Lord, but he has literally worn himself out in the process. And now, on top of everything else, he's got the stress of this threat where Jezebel is going to kill him within 24 hours. And so, he sat down under this juniper tree in the wilderness, and he said, "God, I'm ready to go." Now, let me say this. There's not anything wrong with telling the Lord, "Lord, I'm ready to go. Whenever you're ready for me, I'm ready." That doesn't mean I don't love my family. It doesn't mean that I don't love my brothers and sisters in the Lord. It doesn't mean that I'm fed up and tired of being around everybody and I want a change of scenery. It doesn't mean anything like that. It means that I understand that what's coming next is going to be far better than what's here. And there's absolutely nothing wrong. In fact, I think it is the positive Christian mindset to always live so that you can say, "Lord, I'm ready to go anytime you want me." I will admit there have been some occasions in my life when I became frustrated and I felt a little bit more like what I think Elijah is feeling like here. Notice what he says. "It is enough now." In other words, I've had just about all that I can take. This load has become too much for me to carry. Take my life, for I am no better than my father's. By that, I understand him to be saying, "I thought I could turn the heart around of this people. I thought I could persuade these people to come back to God, but I haven't been any more successful than my fathers have been. So, Lord, I'm ready to die. I'm a failure. I'm disappointed in myself. I don't really see anything else that I can do here. So just take me on home." You know, that's the wrong attitude. And in a roundabout way, I think God showed him that that was the wrong attitude. Let's go a little further. Verse 5 says, "He lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him, and he said to him, 'Arise, eat.' Then he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water." God has provided for him again. God fed him with the ravens there by the brook Cherith. God sent him to Zarephath, to that widow who was just about to run out of food, and she took care of him for a while, for a time, and now God is still feeding old Elijah. You know, the fact is, God is still always there, even when we're down, even when we're disappointed, and even when we express the wrong kind of feelings and emotions sometimes, when we say we're just ready to give up. God hasn't given up on us. God's still there. God's still providing for us. He's still loving us. He's still taking care of us. Even though our response may not be exactly what it needs to be, God can always be depended on. And this angel wakes him up. And he says, "Arise and eat." And he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you." Commentators are sort of divided about whether the angel is really saying, "You've been through so much, you need to eat. You're running on empty, as we say. Or some say that he's looking to the future and says, "You're about to take a journey," and he was. "That's going to be too great for you not to eat and drink. So arise and eat. The journey is too great for you." So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Some 20, 25 or so times the Old Testament refers to Horeb, Mount Horeb, the mountain of God, and most earliest, Mount Sinai. That was the mountain where Moses received the Ten Commandments, the law. For many, many years, there have been disputes and disagreements and arguments and so forth about where exactly that mountain is. The burden of proof seems to be on the side of those who say that it's not really there in the southern portion of the Sinai Peninsula. That's not really where it is. It's actually over there in Arabia. And in fact, the Apostle Paul in Galatians chapter 4 refers to Mount Sinai as being in Arabia. The point is, we don't know exactly where it was, but it doesn't really matter where it was. It was somewhere in that general vicinity, give or take 100 or 2 miles, and that was where Elijah went. Verse 9. He came there to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Now, I don't think that means that God was left out of this, and I don't think it means that God didn't know where Elijah was or what he was doing. I think God is simply giving Elijah these reminders that he needs to get back on course. What are you doing, Elijah? What is it now? What's happening? In verse 10, Elijah said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." There's no inaccuracy there, except for the fact that "I alone am left." He wasn't alone. Maybe so far as he could see, he was alone. He even had a servant. Remember, he left him in Beersheba. Whether the servant came with him on down to Horeb, we don't know for sure. But the fact is, when we get down, when we're frustrated, when we're distressed, when we're depressed, one of the things we generally fail to do is to see all of those folks who are on our side. Verse 11, "So he said," God said, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by." Now, I don't know about the translation you're using, but I'm reading the New American Standard Version, and it inserts punctuation marks in ways that we would, in our modern English, see them as being, as contributing to the meaning of the sentence. And there's a punctuation mark here, the exclamation point. "The Lord was passing by." Exclamation point. That was a very notable thing. That was a marvelous thing, an unusual thing. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. Verse 12, after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. The American Standard Version says a small, still voice. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. Now, in case this seems a little bit just vaguely familiar to you, it's an almost word-for-word repetition of what happened to Moses in the same place on the mountain of God back in the book of Exodus. When Moses asked God to show me thy glory, the Bible says that God passed before Moses. Moses hid in the cleft of the rock. Elijah has wrapped his mantle around his face. And behold, a voice came to him, verse 13, and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" In other words, again, the same question. And again, Elijah answers in verse 14 the same way. He said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant and torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And then God said, "Well, you know, I guess we need to do something about that, don't we?" It's not exactly what he said, but I think that's what he meant. I think what God meant was, "Well, you know, it seems to me it's time we got busy. It seems to me that it's time for us to get up and get to work." And you know, that is good medicine in those times when we get down low because it seems like the good things that we're trying to do aren't working. When it seems like the right things that we're trying to do turn out wrong. When it seems that the success that we're striving for, even in the Lord's work, doesn't seem to be coming through. And so we sit around and we think and we brood. And we think, "Well, there's nobody around but me. Nobody cares but me. I'm the only one left. This is so hard. I don't know why other people won't do right." And on and on and on those things go. You know, a lot of times the best medicine for that is to get busy. And here's what God told Elijah to do. Three things. The Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram," Syria. "You shall anoint Hazael king over Syria." Now, Ben-Hadad was the king over Syria at this time. In fact, we're going to learn about him next Sunday night, Lord willing. And he was an avowed enemy of the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah too. He was an enemy. The Syrians were enemies of God's people across the board. And God tells Elijah, "On your way back, you need to stop by Damascus and anoint this man because he's going to be king." It wasn't going to happen immediately. In fact, we'll read about it later on in 2 Kings chapter 8. Hazael was an advisor, an officer in Ben-Hadad's court and evidently a trusted man. And in 2 Kings chapter 8, it tells how that Hazael killed Ben-Hadad and took the throne himself. And Elisha spoke with Hazael on that occasion and expressed his concern for the terrible things and the suffering that Hazael and the Syrians were going to bring onto God's people. But that happened down the road. But God says, here's step number one that I want you to do. And then God says, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. Well, Jehu wasn't going to come to the throne until we get to 2 Kings chapter 9. But here God is looking ahead and involving Elijah in this matter. And the third thing God says I want you to do is, Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about that the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu, shall put to death, and the one who escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha, shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. And so Elijah departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he was with the 12. And Elijah passed over to him and threw his mantle on him. Apparently, the mantle that Elisha wore had become a recognized symbol of that great prophet of God. And when he threw that mantle over Elisha, Elisha knew exactly what that meant. He left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, please let me kiss my father and my mother, then I will follow you. Now some have tried to put this alongside the passage in Matthew where Jesus calls followers and one says, I will follow you, but first let me bury my father. And the implication was, my father at home is old and he's soon going to die, and so I need to stay and take care of him. Then after I do all of that, I'll follow you. I don't think that's what Elisha is saying right here. Elisha says, I'll be right there. Let me tell everybody where I'm going. And he said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? I take that to mean Elijah was telling Elisha, you do whatever you need to do. And so he returned from following him and took the pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen and gave it to the people and they ate. And it appears that this was after the offering of the sacrifice of the oxen, seemed to be a little going away party for Elisha maybe. Then he arose and followed Elijah and ministered to him. It's interesting in 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 11, where someone later on would ask, is there not another prophet, or is there a prophet that we can consult in this? And the answer was, yes, there is Elisha, the one who poured water on the hands of Elijah. Elisha, even after Elijah was gone, was remembered as the one who ministered to Elijah in his work. And so we come to the end of this chapter. And Elisha goes out of the picture until we get to 2 Kings chapter 2. But here we've got an introduction to him that appears to be a part of the things that God wanted Elijah to do in order to bring himself up out of this depression and this frustration that he felt because of the failure of God's people to see the clear evidence and follow God. Have we taken a good look at the clear evidence lately? If you're not a child of God, what's keeping you from obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ? The New Testament is clear regarding what we need to do. Believing in Jesus as God's Son, repenting of our sins, confessing our faith in Him, to be baptized in order to have our sins washed away. If you haven't done that, this is a good time. If you have done those things, but have become unfaithful in your service to God, this is the time to come back. As we sing this song, we sing it to encourage you if you're subject to the Lord's invitation and invite you to come.